Welcome everyone here this afternoon. We have a very full agenda today, and we apologize. We got off the floor a little bit late, so we're getting a little later start. I am going to take a couple of bills out of order, but then we'll return to the normal order of the agenda, and I appreciate everyone's patience. I'd also really like to encourage people today, because of the length of our agenda, to try to keep your remarks as succinct as possible. Tell us what we obviously need to know, but we'd appreciate it if, particularly if you have prepared testimony, that you not read it to us, but you summarize what you need us to understand about the bills that are in front of us today. I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2758, and I'll open that public hearing right now, and I'll ask Linda Allard, Forrest Soff, and Dean Meisner to come forward if they would, please. Hi, Linda. Do you want to kick off for us?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Linda Adlard. I'm Chief of Staff of the City of Beaverton. We are one of three cities that have currently photo red light enforcement. We were the first city to put red lights in. We've had them since 2001. We have four intersections. We have written about 6,000 citations at those intersections. 75% of those citations are non-Beaverton residents, so we have lots of traffic that goes through our city and are not particularly apparently concerned with our safety standards that we like. We also have experienced a reduction in traffic accidents, all traffic accidents at these four intersections by 12%, and about a 12% reduction in the number of citations at those intersections. And with that, the bill allows any city over 35,000 to have eight intersections equipped with photo red lights.
Thank you, Linda. Forrest, welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I am Forrest Soth, a member of the City Council of Beaverton. I've been a member for 22 years there, and I'll be very brief. This bill does enhance the city's affected ability to enhance their own law enforcement and traffic enforcement conditions because of the fact that it provides one of those tools, and in this day of shrinking general fund budgets, it does enable the cities affected who wish to participate, as Beaverton has done, the ability to use this tool for a more effective measure and a more effective means of modifying the behavior of a lot of those motorists that we're talking about. So with that is just one of the tools that we need to help our budgets, because it does help in those regards. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Forrest. Mr. Meisner.
Good afternoon. I'm Dean Meisner. I'm the traffic sergeant in the city of Beaverton, and I'm tasked with providing traffic enforcement services for a city of 75,000 people and a transit population of more than 250,000 vehicles per day. I've got seven guys to do that job. Four of them are motorcycle guys. To cut to the chase, signal enforcement is probably one of the most difficult and dangerous jobs the traffic guy comes across. When you see a violator, best possible scenario is you have to cut across the grain of traffic to try to catch the violator. That's very difficult to do. In a patrol car, it's almost impossible to do without creating a huge problem. On a motorcycle, it's hazardous at best. I sit in a unique position. When we first implemented this program, I was the guy kind of on the ground floor, as it were, that got to authorize the initial citations through our system. And I did hundreds. And it felt really good to be sitting in the safety of a chair in the office, pushing the button, saying authorize, authorize. And when I saw guys going 70 plus in a 35 mile an hour zone, 25 seconds after the light turned red, trust me, my motor officers do not feel threatened with this technology. We've got plenty of job security in Beaverton. I have lots of things for them to do. We have 125 intersections, I believe. More than that, 169 intersections. Eight is not going to make a dent in my enforcement responsibilities, but it will provide enhanced safety at those intersections. I get calls daily from citizens pleading, please put one of those cameras at my intersection. And that's our position. I represent the chief. You've got a letter there from him. We feel that it would just enhance our ability to provide traffic safety.
Okay. Thank you, Sergeant Meisner. Are there questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski, then Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Sergeant. I was just checking the statute for failure to obey a traffic control device as a Class B violation.
Yes, sir.
In your opinion and your experience, do you believe that maybe we should consider having a mandatory minimum fine to be assessed for people who are actually convicted of running a red light?
You know, that's a good question. I as a guy who's tasked with enforcing and not actually imposing the sanction, we hand out the tickets, and our bail is actually a little higher than it used to be.
Which is?
For our Class B, it's 280.
Okay.
But our judges are allowed some leeway in that. But I'm probably not the best person to talk to as far as what the sanction should be. I'm just here to tell you that it's an extremely hazardous violation. I would venture that most of the violations we see in Beaverton are in the p.m. rush hour time, when people are stacked up and the intersections are past capacity. But I think every city in Oregon has that same problem. I don't know if an enhanced penalty would reduce the incidence of violation. I think that the penalty's fairly stiff now, and we still see a lot of violations.
I'll be checking. When we lived in Houston almost 20 years ago, when we left, I think there was a mandatory fine of about $300.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that definitely was causing some people to have some attention. I don't know if they're still doing it, but I'll find out just to see what results they had.
Okay.
It seems to me that if you hit them in the pocketbook hard enough for those type of offenses, they'll think twice.
Mm-hmm. And from an enforcement perspective strictly, a red light violation is one that we almost always go to court on because it's a perception issue. The person who runs the light doesn't really think they ran the light. The last thing they're looking at is at the light. They're looking at the traffic coming. When we go to court with a photo citation, it's pretty tough for them to say, hey, I guess I didn't run that red light. It's right there in color, if you will. So that's a real bonus for us.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a facetious question. Would you be willing to amend the bill down to cities of 23,111 so we can get in? Last biennium this came through, and I don't think Grants Pass was allowed in, but believe us, many of us down there wanted it badly, and I think it'd do us a good job too.
Anybody else? Okay. Thank you very, very much. We appreciate your testimony today.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
If you're going to move on.
Well, we're not going to go into work session on the bill today.
Well, let me comment then on the bill with Representative Anderson. You know, I find this very offensive that you have to be 35,000 or 300,000 or some number X in order to use this particular technology, and I will be a no vote on this bill as long as it is written as it is now. I mean, I am just offended with that number.
Okay, Representative Shetterly.
Well, I appreciate Representative Jensen's comments, and I think it may be a reflection of how attitudes have changed towards this bill. I think when we went to photo red light to begin with, there was very much a big brother kind of mentality opposed to it, and so I think that it was limited to jurisdictions over a certain amount to limit the number of places where you would find photo red light. And I think the fact is that times have changed, and there's been a substantial movement in the way people feel about this and recognize it much more as a public safety, traffic safety issue. And so, I'm frankly pleased to hear that you're opposed to it on those grounds, because I think two or three sessions ago, the discussion about this would have been substantially different.
Yes. I don't believe I was in opposition to a two or three session.
No,
oh,
I didn't. No,
I'm not implying that you said I was. And I do appreciate that maybe things have changed a little bit, and people's perspectives on some of these issues have changed as far as public safety. And I certainly think your representative Chevrolet is correct on that. But I do feel very strongly that this is a matter that we're not imposing this on the city of Beaverton. We're not imposing this on the city of Portland. This is their decision. We're simply authorizing, if I understand this bill correctly. And I can take you to an intersection, one of the cities that I live in, that it maybe is as dangerous as almost any intersection in the state. That would be well served with something of this nature. So with that, my position, I think, is clear on it.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Okay, now we're not going into work session on this bill. Do we really need to talk it to death right now? Okay, all right, just check it.
I do.
All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2758. We're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3196, and I'm going to invite Representative McPherson, Judy Hammerstead, and John Tung to come to the table. Representative, when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Greg McPherson, representative from House District 38, which includes the city of Lake Oswego within it. And you have before you House Bill 3196, which is it's similar in that it applies photo traffic enforcement as similar to the last bill. But in this case, instead of being limited to cities above a certain size, the availability of photo radar is limited to just 7 cities in Oregon that are listed within the statute. And Lake Oswego is not one of those cities and would like to be added, and we'll hear the reasons why from Mayor Hammerstead and from Dr. Tung here in a moment. But I would note that in addition to Lake Oswego, the bill as before you would add the city of Newburgh, and Representative Backlund is co-sponsoring the bill with me. And in addition to those cities, we have the Dash 1 amendments, which would add an additional 4 cities, the cities of Coos Bay, Milwaukee, Roseburg, and Wood Village, to the authorization for photo radar, and those will be offered up then before action on the bill. So with that background, then I'll turn it over to Mayor Hammerstead.
Thank you very much.
McPherson, excuse me, Madam Mayor, we don't seem to have the Dash 1s in our stack. So if you want to give a copy to council, they'll get distributed to the committee while we listen to the mayor's testimony. Welcome, Madam Mayor, and feel free to begin.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Thank you very much for having us here to consider this bill today. And Lake Oswego asked Representative McPherson to introduce this bill because we felt that it would be add to our ability to enforce, especially speeding, within our residential neighborhoods. We have added traffic control devices, traffic calming, but because of Beaverton, especially Beaverton's very positive experience with photo radar, we feel that this would be a cost-effective method of giving us an additional tool to be able to keep our community safe. It works. It's been a success in Oregon. Modification in driver behavior has resulted from this simply by being notified that photo radar is being employed. Beaverton has seen a drop in their neighborhood and school zones of speeders from 6% to 2%, which is probably about as little as you can get. It only takes pictures of people who are actually speeding, so it's not as if everybody going through the intersection or going down the street is being photographed. We feel that in a time of limited resources, we're trying to do everything that we can to continue to provide our public city services at the lowest cost possible. Our traffic advisory board in Lake Oswego has requested that we support this bill and give them another avenue for safe streets, and we would appreciate your help. I have one other minor observation in regard to Representative Jensen's comments on the previous bill. Whenever you give cities the tools to do the work, regardless of their size or their name, you enable them to do a better job.
And because you have preempted, the legislature has preempted all the cities except for these seven, from a local government standpoint, I would urge you to think about simply opening up both of those bills to the use of the cities according to their local discretion and the will of the people who live in their communities. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Dr. Tong?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Tong. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, and I also serve as a member of the Speed Zone Review Panel for ODOT. Speed is the number one factor killing Oregonians. Speeding kills over 200 Oregonians every year now in the state of Oregon. The average age of death is 27, and they're mostly males. And these deaths are no less violent than the deaths that we've been watching on television in Iraq recently. So it's a very serious public health problem. 45% of fatal crashes in Oregon involve excessive speed. 38% involve drunk driving. There are just as many innocent people killed by speeders, if not more, than by drunk drivers in the state of Oregon. And there are 70 injuries for every death. And as an orthopedic surgeon, I'm much more concerned about the devastating injuries and the impact to their families than the number of deaths. In the mid-80s, I studied the European traffic data and learned that we were 10 years behind Europe in getting our citizens buckled up. The current use, widespread use of photo radar in Europe should be another lesson to us to study. I've been a resident of Lake Oswego for 25 years. We have winding roads, we have large trees, we have very few sidewalks, and very few cul-de-sacs. We have many people who have developed commuter shortcuts that I know Mayor Hammerstedt is also concerned about. And what we don't want, as Officer Meiser from Beaverton pointed out, is police chases through our collector roads trying to track down these speeders. So we ask your permission to study, monitor, and use photo radar responsibly because speeding kills. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tong. Are there questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Representative McPherson, I'm just curious, do we have room in the statute to name all of the cities, or will we at some point reach a critical mass and just take all the city names out and make it for all the cities?
Chair Williams, Representative Krummel, I don't know the number of all the municipalities in Oregon, but I suspect we could add quite a few before it would be less spaced into to put them all in. But I think that based on the way the trend lines are going and this using this technology, I think that at some point it may make sense to do that.
There's 238 cities.
Good man.
Spoken like an ex-mayor, right?
Granite.
Okay, any other questions for the panel? We appreciate you coming forward. Representative Hunt and Jeff Barnes from the City of Salem. Representative, do you want to begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to voice my support for this bill. Really very much along the lines of my colleague from Clackamas County, I actually think that we should maybe even add one more city as you're in the process of doing this. I realize, and I'm not sure whether you're going to be moving to a work session today. If you're not moving to a work session today, I would encourage you to add the city of Gladstone as an additional city on here. And speaking with city officials in Gladstone, they have really the exact same issues that the city of Milwaukee does. If you can envision Highway 99E coming south from Portland, it comes right through central Milwaukee and then comes right down through central Gladstone. So it's really a great opportunity to do what the department has recommended in their latest set of recommendations that came out from the cities, where they said there's no successful way to significantly reduce the number of fatalities and injuries without more cities being involved in the operation of a red light camera program. And so I think it's a opportunity to add one more city. I'd be happy to pursue that on the Senate side if you're moving to a work session today. But if you're not, I would encourage you to do it in this committee.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Barnes.
Yeah, hi. My name is Jeff Barnes. I'm the traffic sergeant with the City of Salem. And yet again, I'm here to add one more city to the list for photo radar. We're trying to move forward with both a photo red light and photo radar program. And amending this bill and adding the City of Salem would allow us the opportunity to continue pursuing that opportunity and see if that will work well for our city.
Thank you, Sergeant Barnes, and we appreciate your reflective thoughts on this. All right. Well, I couldn't. I mean, come on, the guy's glowing in here.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, that was not my forehead you were referring to.
Yeah. Right. All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on 3196? All right. Hearing them, we'll close the public hearing. Colleagues, going to take us into a work session on this bill. And I would encourage both Mr. Barnes and Representative Hunt to pursue their amendments on the Senate side. Because of the time constraints, I think we need to move forward. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3196. And I'll just also state on the record that I fought the battle of photo radar in the 99th session. And the magnificent seven cities that were in there, as we got to be called, it took a lot of work because there were a lot of places and a lot of representatives in this body who frankly didn't want their community to have the opportunity to have this tool. And so it has developed into this sort of self-selecting approach because there were a lot of members who frankly didn't want their community to be able to get there. I agree it's not the best way to approach it, and I would hope that at some point maybe we could just make it available to any city who wants it and leave that to the determination of local government, who ought to be making a decision about whether or not that does or doesn't make sense. That being said, having helped fight to get subsection G in the original bill, which is the city of Tigard, I'm not going to blame anybody for wanting to get their city included in the bill. And I frankly think if we open it up now, there'd be a reasonable chance that the bill might not be successful when it gets to the Senate. Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we are in work session, I would make the same comments on this bill that I made on the previous bill, that I will be a no as long as it is on the selective city sort of thing.
Okay.
I would enthusiastically support the right of any city and any city government to make a decision to use this means of traffic control and public safety,
yeah.
But as it is, I cannot.
I understand, Representative. Anybody else? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having worked with you in fighting that battle in 99 and then for photo red light again in 01, I would concur. I think it's rather interesting how the legislature as a body is very quick and on a preemption to make sure that all cities are included whenever we want to preempt something. But when we when the cities want us to add something back, we're very selective at how we do it, and we start with kind of the usual suspects, Eugene and Medford and Portland, and we managed to get Tigard and Albany and Beaverton in. But I think that this is something that is very good for the local government to be able to make the choices whether or not this is a tool that they want to use. But it certainly is a tool that they ought to be able to have in their quiver and or an arrow in their quiver. And I would certainly suggest that at some point we will reach the critical mass where we just open this up and it's something that all the cities have the opportunity to take advantage of if they so choose.
Good. Thank you, Representative Crummell. Representative Parker?
Move the dash one.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3196. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection on the amendments? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move House Bill 3196 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 3196 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the record?
Mr. Chair, just my urge to my colleague, Representative Jensen, is that I would observe that in this case, there's not a size distinction being drawn between the cities that have the authority and those that don't, and it runs down to even to Wood Village, which I think is only a couple thousand people. So it's unlike the last bill we heard. It's not one that discriminates against smaller municipalities. So if that were sufficiently persuasive to gain an aye vote, that would be a wonderful thing.
You don't have to answer for that, Bob, if you don't want.
I would be happy to respond to that, and I do appreciate, Representative, the fact that we have taken size out, which makes my comments on this less strong, I guess, than they were on the previous bill. or less venomous maybe than they were on the previous bill. However, someday, somewhere, sometime, this body is going to have to come to grips with the reality of including the possibility for all cities, and I'm not sure today isn't as good a chance and a good opportunity as next session or the session after or the session after, recognizing the chair and other members of the judiciary have fought this battle and got a few battle scars to show for it, and I appreciate those. And I appreciate the hard work they've done with it over the time, but on that principle, I'll still stay where I was at.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
No.
Rummel?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Kozlowski?
Excused.
Betterly?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3196 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Having voted against, I will make a floor speech on it and explain my vote on the floor so that people are aware that my no vote here does not have any
deleterious effects.
Yeah, on the.
Okay, good. The bill passes out to the floor. Representative McPherson will be assigned as the carrier. We are now going to go up to House Bill 2590. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2590. I would invite up Representative Tootie Smith, Jana Jarvis, and Joe Woods. It's a lot of people for photo radar and photo red light.
Oh, yes, it is.
I thought you guys were here for the Relitter Lien Bill.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just wanted to ask Representative Smith if this is kind of a tag team presentation that she's got for us here.
Whenever possible.
Welcome, Representative Smith. I'm sorry that you had to endure those other two bills, but I'm sure you found it enlightening. Would be happy to put Malala on the list over in the Senate if you're interested.
I'll pass at this moment, but I thank you for being so generous with the offer.
All right. Please proceed.
Thank you. I was asked to sponsor House Bill 2590 on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. This piece of legislation only applies to commercial real estate transactions and was requested by them for the benefit of the Commercial Overlay Board. 2590 seeks to address a growing problem in commercial real estate today. Unlike residential real estate, brokers' commissions are not necessarily paid out at escrow, and many times a broker has had his fee renegotiated after the transaction has closed. This happens even when there has been a signed contract stating the fee arrangement and the building owner of their representative has had the opportunity to accept or reject a potential tenant. Oftentimes, these arrangements for fees are paid on a lease basis. In fact, it may be because the cost overruns on the owner's part in handling the tenant improvements that drives them into this decision to renegotiate, i.e. cost overruns, even after the new tenants have moved in. Current law allows for commercial brokers to file a lawsuit in order to collect their fees. However, the cost of litigation, both in time and dollars, forces many brokers to accept this fee renegotiation. House Bill 2590 allows for a more level playing field between brokers and building owners, while at the same time protecting the financial institutions that are financing these deals. This bill requires that there be a signed contract by both parties in order for a broker to place a lien. These liens would be subordinate to existing mortgages and loans, and the disputed accounts would be set aside in escrow in the case of a sale. These provisions were included in order to satisfy the financial institution's concerns. However, they seem to object to this act on the basis only that this bill is a lien, allows a lien. It is important for this committee to consider that the court system is already overburdened and that this provision would allow these individuals to seek a more efficient remedy. And I will say one thing. I used to sell real estate in another life, and it was in the 80s. And I was often in times in a situation where back then we called it deferred real estate commission, and I would do that in order to put the deal together. And oftentimes I was left holding the bag, never collect that fee because I had no instrument or means by which to do it except for a very expensive lawsuit. So I would encourage that the committee would look seriously at this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. We don't want to detain you. So if you need to get back to your other committee business, I'm going to open it up to just any questions from the committee, and then we'll excuse you to get back to, I know, your busy schedule. Anything? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative.
Testimony. Ms. Jarvis.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I have brought with me today some written testimony, which I think briefly explains House Bill 2590. And I have brought with me also a couple of my commercial brokers who are going to speak to it in more specific detail. You will note that attached to my testimony is a broker lien chart that gives the most recently published chart I have of broker lien laws as they've been enacted across the country. This is a growing trend. This chart shows that there are 21 states. In addition to that, I've attached another set of testimony from Jim Hockman, who's the Senior Vice President and Counsel for C.B. Richard Ellis out of Chicago. Jim was going to try to be here today. He has been involved in broker lien laws on a national basis. He's traveled to a variety of states and testified on behalf of this. And he has analyzed House Bill 2590. His comments are that this is probably the most liberal proposal that he has seen, in that it sets aside any disputed amounts in escrow and doesn't close up any sale transactions. But you will note in his testimony, he talks about 19 or 20 states with 6 or 7 other states with broker lien laws under consideration. And I believe when I spoke to several of you, I mentioned there were 24 states. I think there are 2 or 3 states that have been added to the list since this chart was published. So I just wanted to bring you up to speed on that. I will note also today that there is, I did notice when we came in and signed up, there's quite a bit of opposition to this bill. We have tried to address the financial community's concerns, particularly in the way we've handled the disputed amount so that it wouldn't affect any kind of future closings. And I am a bit surprised to see the members of the National Association of Office and Industrial Parks here today. I had been led to believe that building owners were neutral on this bill. So with that, I would like to introduce you to, on my far left is Joe Woods, who's the Executive Vice President and Partner at North Speaks & Simpson, one of our commercial firms in Portland. And next to me is Terry Shanley, who's the Managing Director of Cushman & Wakefield.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, do you want to start, Joe, and then we'll go to Terry?
Okay, Chair, Representative Williams and fellow committee members, I believe Representative Kelly summed up the bill very distinctly. She covered most of the points, but some of the points that I wanted to reemphasize, and pardon me if it's somewhat redundant, but I think it needs to be said. First of all, a lien can't be filed unless we have a solid listing agreement. A rogue broker isn't going to be the person that files the lien. It's going to be the principal broker with the firm, so there is some supervision and discretion involved in that situation. The issue of the 2-year lien has been discussed and issues taken with it by I believe the mortgage people. And that time frame is critical for our purposes. One, a lot of times we'll deal with multinational corporations. In any case, corporations that are out of the jurisdiction where it's easy to find them and easy to locate them. So the time element is important to us. The issue that has been mentioned before about the ability to set the lien aside so it doesn't become a encumbrance in a sale where the money goes in escrow and it is negotiated from that point on, so a sale can move forward. The another element of that's important to us is the fact that by having a lien law as opposed to our remedy of a lawsuit, the courts are becoming more and more congested. The lien law is a more equitable way, a faster way to resolve a dispute, and it's mainly in the case of a owner that chooses not to honor the contract that he's already entered into. Oftentimes we've heard a transaction is just a commission apart, so let's move forward and we'll just cut your fee in half. So those are the main issues that I wanted to address, and be happy to answer any questions at the conclusion.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and go to Mr.
Chandler.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you in support of this bill, House Bill 2590. We're here today essentially to accomplish something what I view as to be very simple. We're looking to bring some balance to real estate transactions. Currently, if an owner decides to reduce the fee or simply refuse to pay, there are two methods by which we can pursue payment of a fee that's already agreed to and written in committed to writing in a contract form. That's to sue them, and the other is to send it to a collection agency. Well, we've talked about the challenges of bringing lawsuits. They're very expensive. Unless your fee is in excess of about $200,000, it just doesn't pay to pursue it through the courts. Given the reduced or condensed time frame that the court system is now experiencing due to the economic considerations, we're down to 4 days instead of five. It's been mentioned that our dockets are overbooked already. To realize anything out of a fee that's already been agreed to in that scenario, it diminishes over time. And the expectation of getting anything at all that offsets your attorney's fees and lost opportunity costs makes a leverage out of balance when you do have a dispute if it's less than unless it's a substantial fee, and we're just trying to bring some leverage back to the negotiation. I'm quick to point out that this, in our opinion, is a relatively innocuous bill insofar as we don't expect there to be rampant liens filed, because the people that we do business with are generally honorable people that will comply with the letter of a written agreement. This is only intended to be a vehicle by which we can pursue agreed to fees that are already included in a contract. The burden of proof, it's been said that the burden of proof falls on the owners. It does not. The person that's filing the lien is responsible for proving that it is a valid lien. And this lien, as it's been indicated, can be set aside, so it does not impede the progress of a deal, of a transaction. That's different from a construction lien insofar as it doesn't remain a cloud on the title as a construction lien does. It has to get dealt with prior to moving forward to the transaction, whereby House Bill 2590 does not. It has that provision. I'm in support of it because it is intended to be a last-ditch effort to try to recover fees that were previously agreed to. And right now, as I said, we've got two alternatives, and those aren't terrific alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chandler. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The most recent, I guess, handout here talks about the
other states that currently have the lien availability for brokers. I'm wondering if anyone could provide the committee with the duration of those liens, of how much time each of those states currently provide for those to stay on the books.
Mr. Chair, Representative Posansky, when we drafted House Bill 2590, we had analyzed these provisions in other states, and it was an average of 2 years that these liens were existed.
Okay. I'd still, if possible,
certainly.
Your homework, and it'd be great just to be able to look at those.
Be happy to provide that.
And one other follow-up.
Yes.
Regarding the attorney fees, I know we've met before and we talked about this. It's my understanding that most of these contracts do, in fact, provide for the recovery of attorney fees. Is that not correct, if you have to go to litigation or to collection to collect them?
It is an instrument that can be used in a contract, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, or is it not standard that we are, is that not being used in current commercial leases?
Chair Williams and Representative Posansky, yes, it is used, but again, we have a listing agreement and a commission agreement that's in place as well, and that language is already in there about attorney's fees. But again, if they don't want to pay us, in spite of all that language, there is no way for us to recover beyond that, beyond, again, filing a lawsuit.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. This just occurred to me as you were talking about the agreements. I've never seen one of these commercial listing agreements, but the sale agreements typically provide for arbitration. Do the listing agreements, do the lease, the commercial lease agreements, do they provide for arbitration too?
Sure.
So I guess my question is then, do you bring the dispute to court or do you go to arbitration with it?
Chairman Williams, Representative, they do in most cases. We would prefer that to hold costs down and to expedite the situation. But when we are forced with filing a suit and then going to arbitration, what we're arbitrating is a reduction of our fee. And therein lies the problem. And that reduction or that arbitration usually also splits attorney fees. And no matter what the document says, it gets arbitrated out.
Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, if I may add to that, there isn't an arbitrator that I've seen yet that doesn't want to split it down, make some sort of a reduction or some sort of a compromise. What we'd like to do is, first and foremost, we want to maintain a relationship with our clients, but it gets to the point where you've got to do something like this. We need this vehicle to help give it a little bit of teeth, because we go to arbitration, it's an automatic that we're going to have our fees reduced. Plus, we've got the lost opportunity time because we've got to argue the case. We're taking a broker out of production. They're not out knocking on doors and doing the things that they have to do to earn their livelihood. So it's an issue.
If I could ask one clarification.
Yes.
You said file suit and then go to arbitration. I thought these were usually under the American Arbitration Association, so you go to arbitration first.
Chairman Williams, Representative, that's correct.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony, panel.
Thank you.
Next up, I want to try to do this in order so we get the people in favor before we call up the people against. Is it Bentley? Got a Mr. Bentley on the list.
Well, Chairman Williams.
Yes.
Representative. I'm Gene Bentley. I'm with the Commercial Association in Portland. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego, and I'm here to speak in favor of this bill. I think that there's probably not very many commercial brokers who haven't at one time or another had what we refer to as a commissionectomy. And what happens is you have a signed listing agreement, you've gone through the process either of a sale or a lease, and you get down to the end of it and you've either consummated the sale or lease or you're about to do so, and the owner then starts to knock on your door and say, gee, we've got a lot of problems here, we've got to figure out how to reduce this fee. And so a lot of times you don't have the opportunity to go to litigation. It's before that, and they use this vehicle as a way, the fact that you have expenses and the fact that you have to have time taken out of your business as a way of reducing the fee. And if they would agree to a fee up front that they were going to pay, I think we'd all be happy and we probably wouldn't be here having this issue before you. But that's not always the case, and as I say, there probably isn't a broker around who hasn't had this happen to them. So, thank you. Questions?
Are there questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next up, Pat Jones and Tom Akins. And why don't we bring up, so we move ourselves through, also Greg Specht. Mr. Specht here? Great. Okay. Whichever one of you wants to start. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Tom Akins. I represent NACM Oregon Business Credit Services. That's a member-owned association of over 1,000 Oregon businesses, and I'm a resident of Eugene. The lien statutes allow for the extension of credit on construction projects, giving assurance that payment to those people who provided equipment, materials, and labor will be paid. It's the grease that allows the construction wheel to turn. The 87 legislature took a very comprehensive look at the lien statutes involving all the interested parties. The result of that legislature's work is what we have today. This bill would create a new class of lien claimant, one who did not participate in the construction of the improvement. We believe the lien statutes should remain unchanged and should not be cluttered up with special provisions for parties that weren't involved in the construction of the improvement. With that, I'll turn it over to Pat Jones.
Great. Thanks. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pat Jones. I'm also with representing NACM Business Credit Services. I'm also the Director of Credit for Consolidated Supply Company, wholesale distributor of construction materials in Tigard, Oregon. We believe, and I'm not going to repeat what Tom said, but we believe that the lien law was created to allow a mechanism for contractors and material suppliers to get paid and to facilitate the extension of credit of large amounts of credit. We'll give contractors hundreds of thousand dollars, small contractors, so that they can do a job, whereas a bank might not loan them that kind of credit. And we don't believe that the lien law was intended to create a vehicle to secure commission payments for sales and lease arrangements. The two-year time period seems very excessive in view of the fact that all other lien claimants have to foreclose their construction liens in 120 days. This is would very much be a special remedy. Other civil remedies are available for the collection of commissions. In short, we believe the lien statute should remain unchanged.
Okay, thank you,
Dan.
Mr. Speck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Speck. I'm a commercial real estate developer based in Beaverton, and I come before you today in opposition to House Bill 2590. I also represent the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, an industry group representing 110 Portland area commercial real estate developers and associated businesses. I've been in the real estate development business since 1975 when I built my first duplex right here in Salem. In the past 15 years alone, my companies have been responsible for the development of an excess of 3 million square feet of industrial and office product in the greater Portland and Southwest Washington markets. I fail to see a valid purpose for House Bill 2590 or an existing problem large enough to go through all this effort. You have already heard of some anecdotal stories which would seem to support this legislation, but the vast majority of business conducted in the commercial real estate industry does not require the action contemplated here today. All of my development activities and all of the many properties we continue to own and manage have involved one, oftentimes several, sometimes too many, commercial real estate brokers. In all these years and through all our transactions, we have not had a dispute with any broker, either representing us or one of our tenants, which was not readily resolved. The proposed bill requires that in order to file a lien against the property on which a commission has been earned, a valid listing contract has to be in place. Every listing agreement I have ever signed provides for legal remedies to the broker in the event the landlord fails to make payment as provided for in the contract. The brokerage community complains the court system is too costly and time-consuming. The right to redress through the court system to resolve disputes is the same right available to every other type of business. I do not believe our friends in the commercial real estate industry are so specialized, unique, or downtrodden that they merit extraordinary rights under the proposed law. House Bill 2590 unfairly burdens the owner whose property becomes subject to a lien. The owner is required to prove their innocence, that they do not owe a fee, rather than a broker proving they are entitled to the fee they claim. All commercial real estate is financed, virtually all of it, and all financing documents require the property be kept lien-free or the lender will declare the owner in default. Because the lien must be immediately removed under the financing documents, the owner must resolve the dispute on the broker's terms without the rights provided through the court system. There are legitimate disputes that can arise in the course of leasing commercial real estate or selling commercial real estate. As it relates to leasing, has the term of the listing agreement expired? Have they calculated their commission properly, using the correct amount of time and the correct percentage? Have they claimed a fee for non-commissionable revenues, such as landlord-provided overstandard improvements, which may be amortized by the tenant over the term of the lease? Every listing agreement we sign is modified to fit the transaction or the project. And many of the commission invoices we receive contain mistakes which must be corrected prior to payment. I'd like to respond to a couple of comments that were made by some previous speakers. Ms. Jarvis expressed surprise that NAIOP, the association I represent, is here in opposition. We were not approached when this bill was contemplated. I've been on the local board in Oregon for about 10 years, and not on it now. I have not been on it for 2 years. I've been on the national board. We have over 10,000 members, and I was president of the Oregon chapter. We would not have supported this bill had they come to us. We were surprised to see it in print. My friend Joe Wood made a comment that a lien can't be filed unless there's a valid listing agreement. Well, that's true, but the valid listing agreements provide a remedy section. Are real estate brokers allowed to circumvent the court system, which is the avenue to resolve disputes by every other business in this state? My friend Terry Stanley says this is an innocuous bill. I don't think so. I think this overweights the dispute resolution process in favor of one side of a transaction. Last night, the board of directors of NAIOP voted unanimously to oppose 2590. As an aside, the current president of NAIOP is John Constam, who heads the Colliers International Commercial Real Estate Brokerage Office in Portland, Oregon. I have a tremendous amount of respect for my friends in the real estate brokerage business, and we do business with all these people who spoke in favor of the bill today. However, this bill brought forth is to fix a problem that rarely exists in the normal course of our business, is poorly conceived, and will unfairly burden one side of a business transaction in the rare event when a legitimate dispute cannot be resolved between the parties involved. I ask that you do not pass 2590 out of this committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Specker. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anybody could answer. How long does it take to get such a case into court today?
Do you know? I don't know because I've never been involved in one.
It could take months, especially, well, Chair Williams, I'm sorry, I forgot to address you.
Oh, that's all right. We'll punish you slightly.
Thank you. The point is that the process for getting paid from a lien that you file on the property is a foreclosure, which is a court process, and can be very expensive, too.
In general lien practice, I just might add, Chair Williams and Representative Barker, is that typically you will file a lien. 120 days later, you will file a foreclosure lawsuit.
in the circuit court, which then follows the procedure prescribed basically for any other lawsuit. Those can go on for years.
Yes, follow up on that, Mr. Chairman. What would prevent you, if they had the lien that required you to pay and you think you're being cheated, what would then prevent you from going to court and suing the real estate broker over that?
Chair Williams, Representative Barker, if I can respond, the issue really is not the resolution mechanism for the lien. The problem I have with it as it relates to the lien being filed is it triggers the default provisions of every trustee that's against any commercial property in the state. If you're a savings and loan or a life company and you've loaned money against a property, one of the covenants is you've got to keep that property free and clear of all liens. And even if it's a junior lien, which it would be to the loan. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to send you a note. They're going to get noticed when a lien is filed, and they're going to send us a demand letter saying, cure that lien or we foreclose. Now, that's a pretty onerous result of perhaps a legitimate business dispute. Perhaps it's not a lot of money. Perhaps it's not even warranted. Perhaps the fee isn't owed. And yet the lender is now threatening to declare default against a property owner, which unfairly unweights the decision-making process or the resolution process in favor of the individual who filed the lien.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Yes.
It was my understanding that the escrowing of the fee was the thing that would overcome that, so they weren't really going to foreclose your building, but the money would go into escrow and then it would be resolved out of there. So. Is that not correct?
Representative Williams, Chairman Williams, Representative Barker, I believe the fact of the matter is if there's a legitimate dispute, the money still has to be paid. The threat that there is a gun pointed at the head of the property owner by the broker who threatens to file a lien. Either you pay me or pay the money into escrow and resolve it that way, or I will file a lien. We don't. And I would submit to you that the proper process to resolve these kinds of disputes is contained within the document that the broker prepares, which is a listing agreement. We don't prepare listing agreements. They do. So, and they have a default and a remedy section in those contracts. And I think that's the venue that ought to be used to pursue these kinds of disputes. And again, they rarely happen.
Representative Sherling.
Thank you. I guess that's my question, and I'm sorry if I missed this, if I stepped out, and if you answered it already, you can tell me that, and I'll pick up. But what kind of can somebody give me some fact situation that identifies what these disputes? You've got an agreement that says you're going to pay a commission if a tenant is found. Broker finds the tenant, puts the tenant in the space. Now there's a commission due. On what grounds would a dispute arise?
Chair Williams, Representative Shuttley. Mr. Bentley used the word commissionectomy. I mean, it really does. It does happen occasionally where a property owner will enter into an agreement with a commercial brokerage firm for their services. A fee is earned, whether it be on a sale or a lease. And on a sale, the broker can always put a claim into escrow, and that would have to be determined at that time. But in the event there's no escrow, then a property owner could say, well, gee, Jim, too bad, but I'm not going to pay you the $40,000 I owe you under the agreement. I'm going to pay you $20,000. And if you don't like it, sue me. And then so the broker has to sue. And that may take a couple of years. There's another set of circumstances where there could be a legitimate dispute between a property owner and a commercial brokerage firm, and the property owner says, I will pay you what I believe I owe you under the contract, and the broker says, no, you owe me something else. And it's not going to get resolved that way unless the two parties come to an agreement or one party sues the other. But again, I would submit that perhaps the real estate brokerage industry doesn't should not be entitled to rights that are not available to any other industry that does business in the state of Oregon. I mean, there's no reason for that. If you have a dispute in your own business, the courts are your source of remedy, not lien rights that don't apply.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just to the panel, and I don't care particularly who answers the question, but isn't it correct that if you had a fee dispute with your realtor, and no lien was filed, there's no lien clause, or there's no lien authority, if you go to court and you lose the case, isn't it true that that would be a judgment lien against your property?
Chair and Representative Ackerman, I don't know if it would be a lien against your property. I'm not qualified to answer that. It would be a judgment against the entity that holds the property. I'm not sure they would have the right to enforce it in lien. I'm not a lawyer. I can't speak to that. I will tell you that to the extent you stiff a real estate broker in the state of Oregon, you're not going to be doing much business with them. I mean, it's a very small world, and if you treat one unfairly, the real estate brokers control most of the commercial real estate activity, on the tenant side particularly, and they're not going to bring tenants to your property if you don't pay them the appropriate fee.
I just have another somewhat unrelated question, however. Lien was placed on your property. I'm familiar with the default clauses. Do you have any experience that you can tell us whether a mortgagee or a holder of a trust deed has actually gone through an entire foreclosure proceeding to take back the property merely because a lien was placed on the property?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I don't have any experience. I don't think it's. I have not heard of it, but it's not. It's not a positive event in your day when you get a default notice from your lender on any property, big or small.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
I'm just curious, are there other liens that can be placed against commercial real estate? There's construction liens. Are there other kinds of liens that can be placed?
Chair Williams, Representative Cromwell, I'm not aware of any other of those types of liens that could be placed. And I've been working with construction liens primarily for 18 years now.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, follow up.
With regards to liens that have to be resolved immediately, is there generally, if you receive a letter of default from your lender, is there generally a time frame, a number of days in which that lien has to be, or that the lien has to be removed before they actually take you into default foreclosure?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cromwell, I believe every lender is different, but usually it's less than 30 days. So you cure that lien or else we'll initiate foreclosure. And at that point, you pick up 100% of their costs as well. I mean, the financing documents require that you cover 100% of the lender's costs in that set of circumstances.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My memory is not as good as it perhaps was at one time, but it strikes me that I'm remembering that somebody is using as a reason to deny the realtor request in this particular bill for liens was that they didn't participate in the, was it 1987 lien reform?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, no. The broker doesn't participate in the construction of the improvements to the real property. And I don't believe that they were one of the stakeholders during that 87 revision.
What is this 87 revision?
That's the 87 legislature went through the lien statutes and did a pretty good overhaul.
Involving
people in construction, and bankers, the AGC, many different.
And the position is that you don't believe the realtors participated in that, and ergo, then they shouldn't be coming here asking for special favors?
No, my position, Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, no, my position, our position is that the construction lien laws are for the construction of improvements to real property to facilitate the credit that is granted to allow the construction to proceed.
what this bill is seeking to do is to create a new class of lien claimant, a class that didn't participate in the construction, therefore should not be looking to the construction lien laws for relief.
Follow-up clarification. What was the reason for the legislature dealing with this revision in 1987?
I wasn't actually involved at that time, but perhaps... I'm sorry.
You're all right. Keep going.
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, I wasn't there either, but I know there was they dealt extensively, I think, for instance, with certain provisions. I know the time period for filing a claim of lien, of construction lien, was reduced from 90 days to 75 days to address concerns that the period was too long. There was a lot of other technical revisions. I don't believe I'd be qualified to testify on that at this hearing.
Mr. Chairman. It strikes me that it's pushing 20 years since those laws were, and in fact the argument that the industry shouldn't seek this type of change in the statute might be the same argument that others may have used in 1987 as to why that bill, why the then existing lien laws shouldn't have been changed at that time.
We've got two more panels that we need to bring up on this bill, so I appreciate you gentlemen and will excuse you. I want to ask, I think it's Dwight, and I'm going to probably get the last name wrong, Trahin or Trahane, to come forward, Craig Lewis, Pat Schreck, and if we can pull a fourth chair up, I'm also going to ask Dick Cantlin to come up. That'll facilitate us doing this all in two panels, so we'll just pull a fourth chair up if we can. Thanks, Floyd. And, gentlemen, we've had a fairly lengthy discussion of the issues, so to the extent you can say me too, us too, or ditto, to the extent that that expedites your testimony, the committee would appreciate it. Why don't we go ahead and start with, I got it wrong, Dwight.
Dwight Tryon.
All right, thanks.
I'm with the World Trade Center in Portland. I manage the building there. I also represent the Building Owners and Managers Association. The board has unanimously voted to oppose this bill, and I think I can say that if you just listen to what Greg had to say, this probably echoes our position fairly well. The big concern is liens are a big challenge for us, and we're obliged to just pay them off and then go deal with them, so I'm not sure we really get anything out of the court system with this. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we'll go to Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Craig Lewis. I'm with Melbourne Mark Development Company. We're a commercial realty company in Portland. We are owners as well as developers and brokers. We are against this, and I, again, will not waste your time repeating things that Mr. Speck said for reasons very similar to the ones he's elaborated. I would also want to emphasize that lien rights have proven very specific in their remedies to the construction process. They can be very burdensome. It can also be very costly for owners to address and to make go away, to add another layer on to the potential lieners from the brokerage community would be costly as well as time-consuming for the owners and developers. I guess I'll stop there again. I would like to, I think Mr. Speck articulated the reasons why this is not good legislation, and we would concur with that and would stand against this bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Schreck?
Yes, Chairman Williams, Pat Schreck with Melbourne Mark Brokerage Company.
Live in Beaverton, Oregon. Have been in the commercial real estate commission brokerage business for 25 years. In fact, these people behind me are my closest friends. We just did a transaction of 50,000 feet with Mr. Shanley's office, and we do business daily with every one of the gentlemen that I'm opposing this particular bill for. And the reasons why I'm doing it is I'm sincerely thinking of principles here rather than just what's leverage or not. Just a real brief study. I started in 1977 with C.B. Richard Ellis as a tenant broker and became a landlord broker over the five-year period. Between 82 and 87, I was a principal partner with a small firm called the Corbett Company, same area, Portland, Oregon, so I don't go outside the state of Oregon. From 1987 to 1992, those 5 years, I was with Cushman & Wakefield of Oregon as mainly a tenant rep brokerage because, as you know, sometimes the cycles of economies go up and down. On the upside, you do a lot of business sometimes with developer side, land sales, investment side, such as Gene Bentley does a lot of on those sales. But in terms of the tight market that we're in right now, you become a tenant broker. So the reason I bring that up, there are many sides to a deal. There's landlords you're dealing with, and sometimes you're dealing with tenants only. And sometimes you're dealing with developers only. And so I kind of tried at least over the last 25 years to get at least a good feel for that. Currently, there are about 300 to 400 commercial real estate brokers in the city of Portland, Oregon. And again, I'm just talking about the city of metropolitan Portland, Oregon. I have known over 80% consistently over these last 25 years. Rarely, and I repeat, rarely have I heard of a landlord, especially a seller, stiffing or what we call a commissionedectomy, or not paying a lease. Lots of times, if it does happen, and it has happened twice to me, once from a telecommunication company out of Denver, large firm that Cushman & Wakefield had a relationship with, that was basically we worked with, did stiff us on a lease commission. With the last 10 years with Melvin Mark, I was stiffed once by a small local contractor. I can tell you, saying hearing is very important in this business. The Portland community brokerage, and I'm sure the Salem brokerages and the other small communities, word travels fast. We have emails. We have phones. It's kind of like someone hurts one of our brethren. It gets out real quick. The real reasons why that we've done the past to have handled this is through mediation. Commercial Board of Realtors have a mediation. Rarely do I see that happen. Maybe once or twice a year do we have mediations between landlords and owners and real estate commission or brokers. The reason why that is again, it's a small community, and it does not happen because it doesn't have to happen because, quite frankly, we work very well together. My last thing is that part of this experience that I've learned is that you learn that when the tire meets the road, the only way you're going to make a transaction, a lease transaction in particular, is that the owner has the lender loaning money. In those instances, you come real clear, does the deal make sense for the lender? Because the lender is ultimately going to make that deal happen. It ultimately goes back there because it's not all the cash money that's going by the landlord. So we think if you're experienced enough, you do not want anything to come between that lender and that landlord or that owner. And I think that comes with experience. If someone burns you once, it doesn't happen again in Portland, Oregon, especially. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Cantlin.
My name is Dick Cantlin. I'm an attorney with Perkins Coie in Portland, Oregon. I've been a real estate lawyer for 31 years. I'm here as a board member of NAIOP. I'm also on the Board of Governors of the American College of Real Estate Lawyers, which is probably the preeminent national organization of major real estate lawyers, and I'm the immediate past president of that organization. A quick overview, and I'll answer a couple of questions that were asked that may not have been answered quite satisfactorily. HB 2590, a good idea, you bet, in the sense we'd all like to ensure that the brokers, particularly the ones who you've seen today, who are among the really preeminent people in this state, are paid. In my experience, they are. I haven't seen the kinds of things that have been alluded to, but what I've heard in listening to it is I think it's a fairly rare kind of situation. And my own sense is that we're taking a very large hammer to hit a very small gnat here. What does this bill really do? I can't emphasize enough. Take a step back and see what it does. It creates a very special class of people, and it gives them extraordinary self-triggering rights. I'll tell you a little bit about what those rights do, but just think for a second. The folks who told you what the basis for the lien law, for the kinds of construction liens that are allowed under state statute, are right. It's a question of social policy that legislatures across the country have made over the course of years, and they've said these are the sorts of things that are so important to us that we're going to give some special rights to some special people, those who provide the materials for or construct buildings. Some other states allow it. Yes, that's right. There are some other bad ideas in other states as well. Let's not continue to borrow from them. But remember, this is a very small and very special class of people who have these lien rights. If we start to expand it, where do you stop? I'm an integral part of many real estate transactions, or at least I like to think so in my own way. I don't have any lien rights. Where do I get in line? There are traffic consultants. There are myriad consultants, particularly in large real estate transactions these days. Do they have some special rights? Why are they any different? They've made a major contribution to the transaction. If someone says, I'm not going to pay you, I'm not going to pay you all the money that you're otherwise owed, do they get special rights? Do they get to lien it? I don't think so, and I think you see the point I'm trying to make. Other brokers in other business situations don't have any special rights, the kinds of special rights that are being requested today. I suggest to you this isn't the time to give these brokers any particular special rights. Let's talk just for a second about what's the impact of this lien. We talked a little bit about what the bill does, what its purpose is. What impact does that have? You say to yourself, well, okay, I hear you, Mr. Cantlin, but I think those are good rights as long as they don't have any terrible impacts. Some of you asked some questions. Let me be very straightforward about what happens when a lien hits a property. There isn't a loan document that's been written in the last 25 years that hasn't had an immediate event of default being the imposition of a lien. Is there a cure period? Yes. It depends on the documents. The shortest period that I've seen in terms of a lien of that sort would be 10 days. The longest would be 20. And you say to yourself, have you ever seen a situation, though, where a lender really forecloses? The answer is, you bet. Lots. And the reason is, more and more, lenders, financial institutions, have no discretion. You've probably read and heard how much of our loan market is securitized these days. Loans are put into packages. Those packages are pooled together. Interest in those packages are sold by other financial institutions. Those loans are administered by what are called servicers. Those servicers act with no discretion. Okay? Lien hits, letter goes out, foreclosure in 30 days. So, simple answer to that question. What it does, in effect, is it changes the balance that people have. The lien right increases leverage. Leverage is one of those words, the farther you push it, the stronger it gets. the more leverage that person has, the more havoc that could be wreaked. Would I have any fear of the people in this room, the brokers who are here and those who have testified today doing something inappropriate? Absolutely not. I think they're men and women of impeccable reputation. Do I think there are others out there who would do inappropriate things? You bet I do. And remember what this allows them to do. All you need to say is, all you have to allege, I have a written agreement. That written agreement says I'm to be paid X, and I haven't been paid X. You don't have to have any administrative body or any judge or anybody else question it or do anything else. That becomes a lien. Boom. It hits the property. And once it hits the property, all real estate is financed. It's an automatic default under those loan documents. I suggest to you that is not a result that we should encourage. Are there adequate remedies? Last point. I've never seen a listing agreement in my 31 years that didn't have a remedy section. Now, you can complain, maybe appropriately so, that the court system is too slow, or the court system in some respect is inadequate. But the answer to that is fix the court system. Let's not create some other way to get to an end because we're unwilling or unable to address the central issue. Do I have sympathy for them in that respect? Yes. I have sympathy for all of us who have to deal with the court system these days. But this isn't the place, the time, nor the place to deal with that issue. Are there other alternative remedy structures or remedy methods? Yes, there are. And I think most of the listing agreements, particularly those of the distinguished folks you've heard from today, have a number of different forms of remedy. They have arbitration, they have mediation, they have some type of mandatory provisions. Ultimately, do you end up having to go to court? Possibly, yeah. Have I seen that happen? I think so. I'm hard-pressed to remember, but I could probably name one or two in 31 years. I don't think we need a bill to address one or two in 31 years. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Brief questions to the panel. Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. The list that we have, the chart for individual states that have broker liens, and apparently are 20 in the country at this point. I'm wondering if anyone can tell me how when those really started evolving as to what when states start bringing them on board. Second question would be, if there was a shorter lien period than the 2 years it suggested, would that make it any more palatable? And lastly, I guess, would be the recourse that you would have if someone filed a lien that was unfounded.
Let me answer those briefly, if I could. When did it start? When the brokers gained enough leverage someplace to try and affect legislation of that sort. Number two, does the 2 years make a difference? No, at the extreme, it's the lien itself that's the problem. If it's 2 days or 2 years, we'd have some of the same problem. The shorter the period, obviously, the less problem. But it's a big problem if it's 1 day. And your last question.
What recourse would you have if someone, let's say, instituted a lien and it turned out to be unfounded?
You'd end up in the same place you are now. You'd have, you know, some kind of a tort action that you've improperly liened my property. Good luck. I mean, you know, you have to prove intent, damage, I mean, the whole tort mess. Do I think someone would do it? Probably if they'd been hit two or three times with one of these and was really annoyed, but otherwise, from an economic sense, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay.
A brief question, Mr. Chair?
Thank you. This ought to be pretty short. Isn't it true that attorneys have lien rights in certain circumstances?
Attorneys have, there's an attorney lien right. It has nothing to do with your ability to lien property. It's a possessory right to documents in your possession upon failure to pay an agreed upon fee. It's you know, the moon to blue cheese.
Okay. One more very quickly is if there was a dispute and a lien was filed, couldn't the dollars to satisfy the lien be put into an escrow account, and then that would protect the property owner so that the bank wouldn't foreclose?
The dollars alleged, as I read the bill, could be put in an escrow. Now, there are two issues there. One, I don't think I owe you any money. You do something unilaterally that requires me to put up a bunch of money so that we can then resolve the dispute. Now, that, to me, is troublesome. Second, I mean, the other way you could deal with it, in theory, is that you could probably get a bond. But remember, that takes time. And it also takes a lot of money, cash, liquid money, as does the provision in this bill. And I think, quite frankly, you have an extraordinary imbalance of power there.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Last panel, Jim Marquis, Paul Cosgrove, Tim Martinez. We've heard a lot about this bill, gentlemen, and we have a lengthy bit of work to do before we're done, so you know the drill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services, appearing on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which is opposed to the bill. I would just like to address two issues that haven't, I think, been fully addressed, in both of them in the context of a leasing situation. I think we're all used to, in the residential sale context, the division of the broker's commission between the selling broker and the buyer's broker is all set forth in the earnest money agreement and very specified. That is one of the things that is not specified in the classic commercial listing agreement, and I'm just negotiating on behalf of one of my clients with Mr. Wood's firm, where that issue is all left open. So there are, in fact, cases, that is one, and similar ones where there are legitimate disputes between either the two brokers that then one claims they are entitled to a greater percentage of the lien, of the fee, or otherwise that sometimes need to be resolved. Let me give you one other example of the legitimate dispute issue, which also ties into the time period. This particular lease is not unusual. It's for a 5-year term with an option to renew for an additional 5 years. It's a commercial industrial building. And is also typical, the commission payable is first on the first five-year term, and then if the option to renew is renewed, it is also payable on the second five-year term. And it's payable on the second five-year term in the amount of the minimum rent plus the percentage rent, which is based on a month-to-month sales factor. So those issues sometimes can arise literally five years down the road, and the lien rights under this bill as written would arise 5 years down the road. The bill would provide that the lien would exist and be valid if it was filed 90 days after that event. That's 5 years and 90 days. And then it could be foreclosed 2 years after that. That makes it 7 years and 90 days. So those are the issues that we believe amongst the ones you have previously heard from other witnesses are problematic with the bill. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paul. Jim?
Jim Marquis, on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, we're obviously opposed to this bill, and it's always difficult to oppose our friends with the realtors. We're usually on the same side, as you all know. I'm a great believer, as you all know, in people being paid when they're owed money, and I have been before this committee on that issue many, many times. We just think this bill is unnecessary. There are ways to get this money paid if you're owed a commission. I liked Representative Ackerman's question. You go to court, you get a judgment, you've got a lien. And that's the way to get the lien. Adjudicate it and know how much is owed, and you get the judgment. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Martinez.
Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Me too. That's short.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. I have my head turned, Tim. What was your testimony?
Me too.
Representative Cheddar.
I just wonder how they'd feel about the bill if we amended it to include a lobbyist lien.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you,
just kidding.
Okay, we are going to committee close the public hearing on House Bill 2590, and it wouldn't be the chair's intent, at least at this moment, to go into a work session on that bill. So we're going to move on. I'm going to skip temporarily 2706. Has Representative Close arrived yet?
No.
No.
Well, I know. We just called her, though, and I just wondered if she'd come back, if she'd made it back in yet. I think, nevertheless, we're going to go ahead and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2796.
Bill wanted me to jump up and down.
Yeah, why don't you go bring him in? And we'll wait for the room to clear while we're getting ready for that. We'll get there. Okay, why don't we bring up, Ann Pratt and Mrs. Atura. They'd come forward now, and when Representative Close gets here, she can come to the table. In fact, if you want to wait, I think I see her outside the door.
Please.
Here she is. Representative Close, we're ready for you.
Up front and personal.
Please begin.
Thank you, Chair Williams, and members of the House Judiciary Committee for your patience. I know you have a big schedule today, so we'll try to present this as quickly as we can. Thanks for hearing House Bill 2796 concerning the murder of a witness in a juvenile proceedings. And we did have this bill last session as well. I'm Representative Betsy Close, sponsor of the bill at the request of Crime Victims United of Oregon, and Janice Atura, who is with us here today, and she is the mother of Aaron Atura, and the bill is also in his memory. He was the murdered witness. On October 3, 1994, two gang members entered the Atura home in Eugene and shot Aaron Atura in the back of the head. The purpose of this murder was to prevent Aaron Atura from testifying against another gang member who was a defendant in a stabbing. But in 2000, the Oregon Court of Appeals ruled that this witness murder did not constitute aggravated murder because the victim was a witness in a juvenile adjudication, which the court said does not qualify as a, quote, criminal proceeding. As Crime Victims United has stated, there is clearly a loophole in the law. I feel strongly that our system of law depends upon truth and witnesses being able to safely testify in any setting. The murder of a witness is abhorrent, and the state should exact the strongest penalty it has the authority to give. Passage of this bill will send a message that the state of Oregon will not tolerate the murder of a witness, thereby strengthening our judicial system. And I would like to say we do not support the Dash 1 amendment. I had originally considered it, but I believe it would create a separate and distinct class of punishment for this one crime, and that's a bad precedent. And I'd like to offer the Linn County District Attorney's viewpoint. He sent via email, which is attached to the testimony. He says, I am concerned that if the bill is amended, he does support the original bill, if the bill is amended to provide that a person convicted of such an aggravated murder would be sentenced to life and could not receive the death penalty, serious problems will arise. I think such an amendment would jeopardize the entire death penalty scheme in Oregon and subject it to attack based upon equal protection. For example, why should a person who murders a witness in an adult criminal case get the death penalty and a person who murders a witness in a juvenile case get through life? So he prefers that the bill should pass as is or not at all. And Chair Williams, you also have a letter, I believe, from Brad Berry, District Attorney in Yamhill County. And he suggests that we draft a new bill to try to address it. So I just want to offer you all of these options that have been suggested and to introduce the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there, do you need to go?
I'll stay for a moment.
Okay, great. Then we'll go on then to Ms. Pratt, and then we'll have questions.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'm Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. Steve Dole is actually supposed to be here today, but cannot be because of illness. Actually, Representative Close pretty well covered just about everything, except that there's just a couple things I want to add, and one is that just about everyone who hears this story, and I'm sure you've all heard it before, I've listened to Janice tell it many times to others, they all agree that it is a loophole in the system and we still need to fix it. CVU is in support of House Bill 2796 in its original form, but not in favor of the amended version of the bill. It would be like saying the life of a witness of a in a juvenile hearing would not be equal to the life of a witness in a criminal hearing. If we pass this amendment, we are not only implying that the adult murderer who kills a witness in a juvenile proceeding isn't as serious as an adult killing a witness in a criminal hearing, we are boldly stating it. Aaron Atura was a very healthy 18-year-old young man who had his entire life ahead of him. Let's not devalue Aaron's life or the life of any murder victim by placing the importance of one victim in a legal proceeding above another. Criminal proceeding or juvenile proceeding, the crime is still the same. All the options under the aggravated murder statute should be available at sentencing. We ask you to please pass the unamended version of House Bill 2796 as originally intended. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Good to see you again, Mrs. Atura.
Hi. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janice Atura, and I'm from Eugene, also a member of Crime Victims United. I'm testifying today as the mother of a murder victim in favor of the original bill. On September 1994, my son, Aaron Atura, was a witness in a knife assault by another juvenile. Aaron made the decision to step up and agree to testify against this juvenile offender, Bull Flynn, in the juvenile court in October of 1994. Everything changed when the mother of that juvenile, Mary Thompson, decided to take the matter into her own hand. and ordered the shooting death of my son, Aaron. On October 3rd, around 1:30 a.m., two boys broke into my home and shot Aaron in the back of the head while he was sleeping. At 10:45 in the morning, Aaron was pronounced dead. Joe Brown, Jim Elstead, was ordered to do this by Mary Thompson and to execute my son to prevent him from testifying. Brown received 10 years for murder. Elstead received 16 years for murder. Mary Thompson was convicted of aggravated murder and received life without any chance of parole, the aggravating factor being the murder of a witness in this trial. In 2000, Mary Thompson appealed on the grounds that it was just a juvenile proceeding, actually won that appeal, and it was resentenced to a lesser sentence for murder instead of aggravated murder, just because it was a juvenile hearing. I would like you to stop and imagine for a moment that an adult murderer murdered a member of your family, possibly your mother. Because it was a witness of a criminal crime, to keep her from testifying, the murderer would be found guilty of aggravated murder. And then I want you to stop and think, if it was your sister and she was murdered for her testimony and just a juvenile crime, that murderer could only be found guilty of murder and not aggravated murder. But you need to stop and think that they were all doing the right thing, the same thing that my son did, and they're all just as dead. I believe anyone who orders the murder of a witness at any level of legal court proceedings, whether it be juvenile, civil, or criminal, should be eligible under this aggravated murder statute. Since October of 1994, my family has lived in fear. On May 2nd, in just 3 weeks, the first shooter, Joe Brown, is scheduled to be released from state prison. The second shooter is scheduled to be released in 2008. And Mary Thompson will be eligible for parole around 2020. Aaron got the death penalty. My family and I are sentenced to life without Aaron. I'm asking you to please pass 2796 in the unamended original form. And I thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you, Mrs. Itura. Are there questions for the panel? Okay, thank you. Very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Susan Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we are here in opposition to House Bill 2796. While we're very sympathetic to the personal circumstances that have brought the proponents here today, we are opposed to any extension of the death penalty aggravated murder statute, and we are also opposed to the Dash 1 amendments. It is our position that the current murder statute provides for adequate penalties and discretion for the courts to enhance these penalties where the personal circumstances of the case justify such enhancement. This bill, 2796, would reduce the discretion that a judge has to take into account the personal circumstances of the defendant as well as the facts of the case. As this bill would deal with witnesses in juvenile proceedings, we anticipate that there may be a higher or disproportionate number of defendants who are themselves juveniles. As a result of Measure 11, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds are subject to adult court prosecution, including for aggravated murder, as a matter of law. The murder statute currently requires a mandatory 25-year sentence. The court may depart beyond that when the facts are aggravated and merit this. An execution-style murder, I submit, is such an aggravating factor. There are murders that involve less egregious and less aggravating factors. A murder may result through a fight, a rash decision, in which death wrongly occurs, murder conviction would rest, but it may be less egregious. It may not involve premeditation. It may not involve any well-thought-out plan. Members of the committee, in our opinion, a mandatory life sentence may be too long under those circumstances. And therefore, the OECDL opposes both the original bill and its Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. To start your testimony, I think you said something that to the effect that that you objected, or the objection was to any extension of the capital punishment statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's correct.
And may I conclude from that that there may be an objection to the capital punishment statute as in general?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes.
Excuse me, but I probably can understand the first objection to capital punishment. I think there's legitimate arguments probably on both sides of that issue, and they have been debated across the country on and on. But somehow, how do you reconcile, given the fact that we do have capital punishment, that one murder, in exactly the same murder, as far as the illustration we have, an execution murder, is punishable by death. And in another case, in this case, a juvenile proceeding is where the witness is in a juvenile proceeding, it is not. I have difficulty with that. I have no difficulty with the understanding of your position on capital punishment. But if we have capital punishment, I have difficulty understanding why you would object to this and see it as an extension of capital punishment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I do think it would be an extension in that these cases that involve juvenile proceedings as opposed to adult court proceedings are not currently, by case law, covered. So I think it would be an extension. Whether the juvenile proceedings are cases that have... I take your question in some respects as whether they are sufficiently distinguishable from cases that are currently covered to justify not being covered. And as I said in my testimony, one of our concerns is with juvenile proceedings that we may see a disproportionate number of juveniles that are charged with these kind of offenses or become involved in these type of offenses. I have nothing further to add in terms of distinctions.
Okay. Yes, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When this law was first put in place, is it your understanding the legislature believed that a juvenile proceeding would? I mean, the appellate courts reversed on this, so it would be my thought that the law that was in effect, the legislature intended to, believed they were covering that crime.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that may very well be the case. I don't have any personal knowledge of that. I wasn't down here at that time. It was my first session, so it may very well be the case.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, it's been a while since I read the Thompson case, but my recollection was the first time this was addressed, and David Ainsley from the Department of Justice is here, our Supreme Court interpreted that it did apply. It went then up an appeal back in 1999, and before the first case and the second case, the courts established a statutory interpretation based on PGB Volley, text versus context. They applied that analysis and determined that a juvenile proceedings was not a criminal proceedings, therefore the statute did not apply. So what you have is two different court cases, about 20 years apart, and in between a different analysis of how you interpret statutes. Before, they would look more towards the legislative intent. Now they only, under PGB, only look at legislative intent once they get through text and context.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you, Susan. Colleagues, I carried this bill 2 years ago as it came out of this committee and onto the House floor in the form that you have the bill in front of you, and it got through the Senate and it got vetoed by the governor. And so before we went through that process this time, I approached the governor's office frankly, at the response to an inquiry by Representative Close to determine whether we could get a different result this time. And the answer was, as you have the letter that's on your desk, the answer is, in its original form, no, the bill would get vetoed. And that was reconfirmed to me this morning in a communication with the governor's office. They would support the Dash 1 amendments, but as we've heard, there are people who oppose the Dash 1 amendments because they think that it weakens it. I will tell you that my personal opinion remains that the form in which an individual is testifying that is murdered should not be the deciding factor as to whether or not a person is subject to a charge of aggravated murder. I think it is an anomaly, and it makes for an unequal level of justice based on a crime that's committed, and that should not be the deciding factor. But I'm enough of a pragmatist to not want to waste anybody's time running this bill out of committee, only to have it vetoed. And I think it raises a whole specter that we went through last session that's not of much value. There's also a letter from Brad Berry that was referenced by Representative Close. The district attorneys are concerned with leaving it as an aggravated murder charge, but they recommend that there would be some other option that they would be willing to consider as an association that would allow at least a true life charge against an individual who committed this kind of a crime. We're not going to do any of that today, but I wanted that information on the record and for the committee's consideration. And we can have a conversation about it, or you can ponder it later, and the parties who have put the bill in and who have raised these issues can potentially discuss it among themselves as well. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2796. Next, we're going to go to 2706. I'm going to open a public hearing. And I'm looking for my, here it is, my sheet. And let me guess, that's Stephen Cafori and George Caffey, am I right? All right, Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon on supporting House Bill 2706. We thank the chair for and a number of members of this committee for sponsoring and co-sponsoring this legislation. You just heard a long description of another lien, and I hope that we can be a whole lot briefer than that. Let me briefly say that we are not proposing a brand new lien. What we're doing is asking for a relatively minor extension of a lien right that surveyors presently have in ORS Chapter 87. There are some problems with the existing lien law for surveyors right now, and that is that there are at least one activity that that used to have a lien right, but this law, as you know, has been rewritten many, many times over the generations, and right now we do not have a lien right for boundary surveys. And this bill originally was a bill to just give us the right to lien on boundary surveys. There may be a couple of other small items that there's some clarification needed on because of the definition of what is an improvement to land that presently is involved in the construction lien areas. So we decided to draft a new statute that just says we have a law giving us lien rights for those things which land surveyors need to be licensed to do, just so there is not a problem about what exact services would be covered and what they are not be covered. Because of past experience in this committee, Mr. Chair, with the issue of construction liens and other people who have construction liens being unhappy with that, we decided to make this bill not a part of the construction lien statute, but the miscellaneous lien statute.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, you said not the construction lien, but what?
There's a miscellaneous lien statute. Let me just add one other quick thing, and I'll introduce Mr. Caffey, and that is that we do have an amendment to the bill, just to clarify that it's not only an owner who might make a contract, but an agent of the owner. And I'll pass that out, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Somebody. Mr. Caffey, are you ready?
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm George Cathy. I'm a practicing licensed land surveyor in the state of Oregon. I reside in Salem, Oregon. And I'm also the chairman of the legislative committee for the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. Currently, there are trades who are entitled to provide services and materials to projects, and they have the recourse of a lien. Also, currently, engineers and architects have the ability to place liens for their services against real property. And land surveyors on a very small segment in ORIS 87 have a narrow window to provide liens. However, the services that we do provide, which are many, most generally people review us or see us as that fellow standing behind the three-legged camera thing out on the highway waving at people when they drive by. But we do lots of other things that are beneficial, and actually we consider an improvement on the property, because without the improvement that we put on the property, people cannot divide land, they cannot survey land. In certain cases, there are ordinances, city ordinances, that say that you cannot add onto your house, you cannot build to your house, you cannot put a driveway in without having a surveyor provide survey stakes on the ground showing where the improvement is supposed to go or where the property lines are supposed to be. The upshot of it is that occasionally collecting our fees does not happen. We can use the court system. I have had personal experience of using the court system. I've gone into mediation and arbitration, and eventually we always end up in the courtroom having the judge adjudicate that our fees are reasonable and have been contracted for. ORS 672 defines what is the practice of land surveying, and it defines setting boundaries, doing topographical work, and things of that nature. We feel, as a professional society and a practicing legislative group of individuals, that we should be able to have the ability to lien a project or lien the property when so contracted to do so. We also believe that engineers and architects who have lien abilities, land surveyors who provide like services, should also have similar rights and similar recourses to be able to lien the property. We have brought with us some examples of land surveyors who have provided what we considered improvements on the property, that is, divide the land, put the property corners in, provide plats and maps, which are recorded at the County Survey Records Office, which have gone through planning departments, various different government agencies for approvals, which all constitute, we feel, improvements on and to land. As in with the trades who provide shingles and plumbing and materials and labor to improve the land, land surveyors feel that we also provide similar activities and substances that are a benefit not only to the owner, but uniquely enough also to every adjoiner that abuts property that we do our survey work for. So it's extended beyond just the person that we do the survey work for. So again, we feel that we should have the right to be able to lien a project or lien property in which the improvement is performed on.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Cathy. Are there questions for the panel? We're sort of feeling a little leaned out, I think.
I bet.
Mr. Chair, I just...
Representative Crummell?
Can I just... I'd like to confirm something here, because I'm reading 87010. And it appears as though architects, landscape architects, land surveyors, and registered engineers who perform services at the request of the owner or agent do already have lien privileges. Am I reading this correctly?
Mr. Corey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that's correct. There has been some interpretations that a boundary survey is not does not fit under that statute, and that's been the problem.
Well, what the hell is a land survey then?
So, Mr. Chair, a boundary survey. Yeah.
Well, are you looking in the is that the construction land extension?
This is 87.010 sub 5.
Yeah, those are all services. I think if my recollection from this issue last session, those are all services geared toward an construction of an improvement or actual improvement of a property. And this would extend the survey right to maybe just a boundary line survey or a survey that's not necessarily done for the purpose of constructing an improvement on the property. So I think that's partly what this is about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shuttle, that's exactly what this is about. If someone has a boundary survey done and they're not planning to build on that for 2 years, is that an improvement to land or not? We think that's how many angels do dance on the top of a pin, and that's why we'd like to clarify the length, clarify the situation.
Representative Ackerman?
Well, I think it also would apply to something like a partition, but there's no improvement involved. You're just redrawing lines all around.
Well, Mr. Chair, a boundary line survey before you cut timber or something like that, where you want to make sure you're cutting your own timber or putting in a fence. I suppose that's an improvement technically, but
yeah,
cutting timber, yeah. That'd be one too.
Okay. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Jack Monroe, Jim Marquis, Paul Cosgrove. I'm going to let Jack go first because he's neutral, at least on the box he checked, and then the two opposers could go after that.
Opposers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And when my people, I guess, reviewed this, they had some questions about why, given the other liens, but obviously I'll leave that policy issue to your wisdom, as I always do. But they did notice in dealing with it that, pardon?
Begrudgingly.
Well, there are those times. They did notice a technical question, and so I'll raise it. That is, the bill really creates a super priority and puts it in a series of statutes that provide for liens against land. The ones that are there are mining, nursery, irrigation, power-related. The last statutory provision in that sequence, 87392, prioritizes those, A before B, B before C. And this bill creates a lien, but doesn't speak to where it goes in a sequence if there are multiple liens that may be applicable. And so you might want to take a look at that, and if you choose to advance the bill, either amend it here or send it to the other side with a notice that needs to be looked at.
Okay, thanks. Paul?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Service Association, and we're opposed to the bill. One of my comments was going to be exactly the one that Mr. Monroe said. Some of those priorities established for the series of liens in this series are ahead of prior recorded mortgages. Others of them are behind prior recorded mortgages. So that's obviously a very important issue where the priority would be set of this lien. The reason that we have concerns is this is one of those secret liens that lenders really have trouble with. It attaches on the day the work ceases, but it doesn't have to be recorded and therefore wouldn't be known of record for 120 days thereafter, and it doesn't have to be foreclosed upon until 6 months after recording. The other issue that's raised by the amendment by adding the words "or agent" under the construction lien statute on which other liens arise, if work is ordered by someone other than the owner is entitled to notice of the potential of a lien and how they may protect their interest in property by ensuring that payment goes to everybody who's in the construction or work process. This lien, by putting it in this series, does not have any of those consumer or owner protections, and that's an issue that's now raised by the amendment, although it wasn't in the original bill. So for those reasons, we're opposed to the bill.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Paul. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. And the only thing that I would have to add to what Paul has said, we are opposed to the bill for obviously the same reasons. But there is one other thing that I want to bring to your attention, and that is under present law for these kinds of services, a surveyor, if there was a dispute, a contract dispute, they have a contract claim and they go to court. Most of these claims are for small amounts in these cases, relatively small amounts, and could be adjudicated in a small claims court, which is fairly quick to do. The Oregon legislature several sessions ago made a very, very clear policy statement by adopting legislation that prohibits foreclosing on a judgment lien against a person's home to satisfy a debt for less than $3,000. And they did so for a legitimate reason, because they don't want people losing their homes over some very, very small debt that may be disputed anyway. Under present law, if a surveyor went to small claims court, got a judgment, and thereby got the lien, they would be prohibited from foreclosing on that lien, just like any other judgment creditor. If you enact this, they bypass that, and they could foreclose on one of these very small liens and thereby get around the policy that the legislature created in the first place. So I just bring that to your attention.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for the panel? Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2706, and this stands in the same position based on my ability to define my committee's thoughts as the last one. So we'll not go to work session on that today. We have a couple of items of business and House Bill 3340 still left. I've only got one person who indicated an interest in House Bill 3340. It's Mr. Gallant. Is there anybody else here on that bill? You there? Are you for it, Rich? I mean, not for the bill, but you're here to testify on the bill?
I will be speaking against the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So why don't, if you two could sit tight for a minute, I'm going to... we're going to try to do these work sessions while we've still got a quorum before I know I start to lose people here pretty quickly. So if the committee will indulge me, first we're going to go to the bottom of the agenda. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2308. Colleagues, this was the one HIPAA bill that we didn't do anything with. The request is, just based on the relating clause, that we send the bill without recommendation to Representative Cruz's committee, the Health and Human Services Committee. So the chair would move that we refer House Bill 2308 to the Health and Human Services Committee at this time without recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection?
Sound away.
Motion carries and the bill is referred. We'll show Representative McPherson, Representative Barker as excused on the bill. Next, I want to open a work session on House Bill 2279. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you remember from our last hearing on this bill, 2279 deals with enactment of the revised Uniform Arbitration Act. You have in front of you -2, -3, and -4 amendments. The -2 amendments, I got a note from legislative counsel, are probably not appropriate. They delete a section regarding arbitration.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think we just have four.
Yeah.
All I've got is fours.
Okay.
That's all I've got also.
But if we don't need two anyway.
You don't need two.
All right. So
right now.
Two's off the bus.
And then you should have, just finding my copies, a -3 and a -4.
We don't have the threes.
Well, I've got -4.
You don't have a four? Look in your, did you look through your stack?
Mm-hmm.
We might need some more copies of the four. Okay. Who's here to talk about this for us? Jack, you want to come up? Paul, you want to come up? And then I think we've got someone here from the bar.
Jim Davis.
How are you? Amos, if you want to sit down, and maybe while we're getting the amendments, you can tell us what the threes and fours do. And why don't we give Mr. Damus the chance to to just bring us up to speed.
I'm not sure which. Are we at something called 2279-1? Is that what you mean by the dash?
No, I think we're going to be at dash 3 and dash 4.
Dash 4 is the.
And I don't know what the dash 3s are.
Do we even have the.
Got the 4s to
hand. Okay, and the 3s are being printed.
Copied. And it's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that the dash 2s. Were brought to me from Jack, wanted Section 28 removed.
Well, this, the dash 4s
the dash 4
follow
include
those.
That?
Yeah.
Okay. And then the dash 3s are the lengthy ones that are being copied, and maybe you want to speak to those.
You don't have
but them. I don't have them.
Nobody has them. we could
adjust the dash 4s if you'd like.
It's been a really long week. Why don't you tell me what the dash 4s do, and then we'll back up and get the dash 3s when they get here.
The dash 4 is easy. Section 4 of the bill talks about certain provisions that cannot be waived by the parties before an agreement, arbitration agreement. A dispute arises, and also provisions that are not waivable under any circumstances. And the insurance industry has a long established practice of resolving disputes between insurance companies. They enter into these wide-ranging national agreements in which insurance companies say, if we have disputes among ourselves over coverage issues, we're going to do arbitration. And the arbitrator's award is going to be final. Nobody can appeal it. And the insurance industry says, why shouldn't we be able to continue to do that? Why can't we waive the right to have a judge second guess or to an appeal? And that's what this bill does. It exempts from Section 4 agreements to arbitrate that are agreements between insurers to arbitrate basically insurance disputes. And the bar has no objection to that. If the insurance industry wants to do that, that's fine with us.
Okay. Well, we know what the Dash 4s do, but is there anybody here in support of the Dash 3 amendments?
It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, looking at the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s, that the Dash 3s are just a later version of the Dash 1 amendments. And I only have two notes in my file for folks working on amendments to this bill.
Who wanted the dash ones?
That was a bar proposal.
Okay, my guess is what the dash threes are when we see them. It's probably a combination of the dash ones and the dash twos, which would be a standard practice for LC to include those two in a dash three amendment so we could adopt just one amendment. But why don't you, with that in mind, explain to us the dash ones?
Okay. There are.
We don't have the dash ones either.
Okay.
We don't have the dash ones either.
Okay. Well, you know what we're going to do? We're just not going to do anything right now. Let me just get this on the record. You insurance guys are fine if we adopt the dash fours, right? You don't have any objection to the bill?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay, is there anybody else here who wants to complain about this bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can we just a clarification? You're okay with the dash 4s, but us not seeing what the dash 1s or dash 3s are, have you seen those to take a position on that?
Well, my guess, Mr. Chair, Representative Krasanski, my guess is there's nothing in the 3s that's likely to be of specific interest to us. But
okay.
We can hear that.
I just want to make sure.
We would, of course, like to take a look at them.
I wouldn't guess anything in this bill.
No,
all right. Well, here, because we don't have everything else in order, even though they're being passed out right now, and I just feel like this whole thing is starting to crumble, I'm going to go ahead, while we've got our guys here on the record, at least adopt the Dash 4 amendments into the bill. So the chair would move the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2279. Any objection by the committee? All right, the Dash 4s are in the bill. And then what I think I want to do is allow you to have a chance to take a peek at these Dash 3 amendments And then we'll bring you back up and have you so you can see what they are, so you're not testifying about something you don't know anything about because you haven't had a chance to read it.
Okay.
Is that fair? So I'm going to go ahead and recess the work session on House Bill 2279, and I'm going to hopefully try to do something easier.
I've looked at them. They're the same. I mean, I can tell immediately what you said was true, that that three is just a reworking of the one. And
so you're fine?
I know because I drafted them to begin with, and they're just very little. Yes.
Okay. Then I'm going to reopen on 2279, the work session. Why don't you tell us what the threes do then?
All right. The three does several things. It allows in Section 16, it allows an out-of-state lawyer to represent a party in arbitration, just as if an out-of-state lawyer could represent someone in court. Our problem is our current statutes allow a procedure for an out-of-state lawyer to come in and, with court approval, take part in the proceeding. But there's no statute that allows a court to allow an arbitrator in a non-judicial proceeding to enter an arbitration proceeding. So this would allow an out-of-state attorney to participate and represent a party in an Oregon arbitration. And arbitrations are not so complicated that an out-of-state attorney can't come in and appear in an arbitration. Section 17, which is the section that talks about subpoenas and depositions, on the attorney issue, it also allows a corporation to appear in an arbitration without the necessity of being represented by an attorney. There's this oddity we have in the law that says a corporation can only appear through an attorney. But what this does is say a non-attorney, such as a corporate officer, could come in and represent a corporation in an arbitration, in the same way they do, for example, in proceedings in the Department of Human Services. In Section 17, the issuance of subpoenas. In state court, an attorney can issue a subpoena to require someone to appear to testify in court. This extends the right of an attorney rather than simply an arbitrator signing a subpoena, which is the current practice in Oregon. To get a subpoena to someone to testify at an arbitration hearing, you actually have to have the arbitrator sign the subpoena, which means a party or the attorney has to go through the process of preparing the subpoena, getting it to the arbitrator, who signs it summarily, doesn't look at it, send it back to the party, who then serves it. And so this seeks to do for requiring a subpoena for an appearance in an arbitration hearing. It allows the attorney to sign the subpoena in the same way that an attorney could do to require someone to appear at a court hearing.
Let me ask you, Mr. Demas, is there any... were these consensus amendments, these dash threes?
Nobody's objected to these.
Okay. And they came from the work group who was working on trying to do the uniform arbitration.
It came from the Oregon State
Bar.
Bar, yes, through, and also through my talking with Jim Noel,
right,
who was the attorney in Oregon who actually participated in the uniform arbitration, the drafting of this act. The other sections refer to the confirmation of an award and the vacating of an award, the correction of the award. And what these amendments do is really adopt the portions of our existing Uniform Act, changes that were made in Oregon by the Oregon legislature to the original Uniform Act that was submitted. And what it does is it makes sure that before someone tries to confirm an award as a judgment of the court, the other side has to be told that someone is trying to get a judgment out of this award. And then the
the other side then has 20 days in which to object.
Here's what I think we're going to need to do, because this is probably more than we're going to be able to cover. I'm going to ask counsel to go ahead and we apologize, because we know you've been patient through a long hearing waiting for this, but I'm going to lose my quorum here because we're past our time. So I'm going to ask counsel to put this back on the agenda for a work session. It might be helpful for us to just maybe get a one sheet sort of bullet point discussion about what the amendments do in a way that we can maybe move quicker on them. And I promise, if you feel like you have to come down again, we'll put you at the front of an agenda so you don't have to listen to 2 hours of lien testimony and an aggravated murder issue. But I'm going to lose my votes here in a second. And I feel like I don't want to rush the committee, because I don't know that the committee feels comfortable, because they don't have your information about what these amendments do.
Well, as far as getting here, I know the way now.
Yeah.
And as far as explanations, I've already done that. So it'll be very easy for me to prepare a copy that explains the background and the reason for the amendments.
That'd be perfect, Jim. We appreciate it.
Chair Williams, just to get on the record that these are consensus amendments. My name is Joyce Patton. I'm with Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Program. These are consensus amendments, and we have also had discussions with the Construction Contractors Board and Landscape Contractors Boards. And their amendments are incorporated in these, and I will be glad to provide a one-page summary of bullet points for you.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you both. Going to close the work.
Chair, can we also get copies of the amendments that are going to be pertinent as far as...
Yeah, and I think it's going to be these dash threes, and we've already adopted the dash fours. So,
thank you.
All right, we're going to close the hearing on 227, or the work session on 2279. I'm going to ask that 2069 and 2235 be held over for another day. We'll get them back on the agenda. I do want to open a public hearing on 3340. I'll ask just Rich Lane and Scott Gallant to both come up briefly. It's a public hearing, and this is not going to go into work session today, so if people need to leave, they can, and we can continue to take the testimony. And I apologize again for making you gentlemen wait. Obviously, we had a longer hearing today than we'd anticipated. And if you gentlemen just want to maybe briefly state your, because both of you, I think, have signed up against the bill. It's a unique date to see doctors and the lawyers at the table both opposing the same piece of legislation. So,
but there's still a chairman.
Mr. Chairman, you took my line.
I'm sorry. I apologize. All right. We'll pretend like I didn't say it, and now you can say it, Scott.
Go ahead.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Richard Lane, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Okay.
Scott Gallant, representing the Oregon Medical Association.
All right.
Despite what HB 3340 says, that this is my bill, this is not my bill. That entire Section 1 is abhorrent to my organization. I can't say it any stronger. So we would encourage you to just let this bill die somewhere.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, other than that very succinct statement, my counsel advises me that Section 1 of the bill also violates Section 3, Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, and we would also recommend that the bill disappear.
You make my life simple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen. Hearing's closed on 3340.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
If we can have a photograph.
Yeah, really. How about you kiss, giving each other a big warm kiss? There you go. All right, we're adjourned.
I gather that went away.
What a sideshow.
I wanted to see who was in the middle of the chair.
Yeah, well, sometimes things happen.